The Selected Shorts podcast is sponsored by Audible.com, home to over 75,000 audiobooks and more, including the Thalia Book Club and Selected Shorts series. Learn how to download a free audiobook at audible.com/symphonyspace.
From PRI, Public Radio International.
He opened the door, smiled at the kid who looked up at him doubtfully, his green eyes swimming in that pallid little face, as huge as the eyes of a waif in a velvet painting, you know, the kind advertised in the cheap weekly tabloids like the National Enquirer and Inside View. "Step into my parlor, little buddy," Sheridan said, and produced a grin which looked almost entirely natural. It was really sort of creepy how good he'd gotten at this.
You're listening to Michael Imperioli reading from Stephen King's story, Popsy, which we will hear on this edition of Selected Shorts, a series that originates in live performance on stage at Symphony Space in New York City. I'm Isaiah Sheffer. Creatures of the Night is the title we've given to this program, and while the stories you will hear in this hour are indeed tales that center on the time after sunset, they come from very different worlds. We begin with a properly scary Stephen King tale, which was part of a Halloween vampire-themed evening at Symphony Space. The evening was inspired by the publication of the anthology The Vampire Archives. Here's a sound bite from editor Otto Penzler.
I made the selections for The Vampire Archives by reading about 500 stories. I thought this was going to be absolute agony because I thought, how many variations on a single theme could you have without being overly repetitive and excruciatingly boring? Much to my surprise, I found that there were wonderful ways of approaching this, from a subtle, is it really a vampire story by people like D.H. Lawrence and Arthur Conan Doyle, to violent figures, to sympathetic characters who were always being hunted by vampire hunters, who had to live forever and ever, knowing everything and getting bored with the world, but not able to die. There were so many approaches that it really became an interesting exercise in putting together a very varied collection.
That was Otto Penzler, editor of The Vampire Archives. And from that volume, here's a Stephen King story with the cute and slightly scary title, Popsy. Perhaps some parental guidance should be exercised in allowing it to be heard by impressionable children who might quaver at the thriller about kidnapping and worse. The reader is a proper television bad guy, Michael Imperioli, who played the role of Christopher on The Sopranos until Uncle Tony terminated him. Michael Imperioli reads Stephen King's Popsy.
Hello. Sheridan was cruising slowly down the long, blank length of the shopping mall when he saw the little kid push out through the main doors under the lighted sign which read, Cousin Town. It was a boy child, perhaps a big three, surely no more than five. On his face was an expression to which Sheridan had become exquisitely attuned. He was trying not to cry, but soon would. Sheridan paused for a moment, feeling the familiar soft wave of self-disgust. Though every time he took a child, that feeling grew a little less urgent. The first time he hadn't slept for a week, kept thinking about that big greasy Turk who called himself Mr. Wizard, wondering what he did with the children. "They go on a boat ride, Mr. Sheridan," the Turk told him, only it came out, "They go on a boat ride, Mr. Sheridan." The Turk smiled. "And if you know what's good for you, you won't ask any more about it," that smile said, and it said it loud and clear without an accent. Sheridan hadn't asked any more, but that didn't mean he hadn't kept wondering, especially afterward, tossing and turning, wishing he had the whole thing to do over again so he could turn it around, so he could walk away from temptation. The second time had been almost as bad. The third time, a little less. And by the fourth time, he had almost stopped wondering about the boat ride and what might be at the end of it for the little kids. Sheridan pulled his van into one of the handicapped parking spaces right in front of the mall. He had one of those special license plates the state gave to Crips on the back of his van. That plate was worth its weight in gold because it kept any mall security cop from getting suspicious. And those spaces were so convenient and almost always empty. You always pretend you're not going out looking, but you always lift a crypt plate a day or two before. Never mind all that bullshit. He was in a jam, and that kid over there could solve some very big problems. He got out and walked toward the kid, who was looking around with increasing panic. Yes, Sheridan thought, he was 5, all right, maybe even 6, just very frail. In the harsh, fluorescent glare thrown through the glass doors, the boy looked parchment white, not just scared, but perhaps physically ill. Sheridan reckoned it was just big fear, however. Sheridan usually recognized that look when he saw it because he'd seen a lot of big fear in his own mirror over the last year and a half or so. The kid looked up hopefully at the people passing around him, people going into the mall eager to buy, coming out laden with packages, their faces dazed, almost drugged with something they probably thought was satisfaction. The kid, dressed in tough-skin jeans and a Pittsburgh Penguins t-shirt, looked for help. He looked for somebody to look at him and see something was wrong. Looked for someone to ask the right question. You get separated from your dad, son? Would do. Looking for a friend. Here I am, Sheridan thought, approaching. Here I am, sonny. I'll be your friend. He had almost reached the kid when he saw a mall rent-a-cop ambling slowly up the concourse towards the doors. He was reaching in his pocket, probably for a pack of cigarettes. He would come out, see the boy, and there would go Sheridan's sure thing. He thought. But at least he wouldn't be seen talking to the kid when the cop came out. That would have been far worse. Sheridan drew back a little and made a business of feeling his own pockets as to make sure he still had the keys. His glance flicked from the boy to the security cop and back to the boy. The boy had started to cry. Not all out bawling, not yet, but great big tears that looked pinkish in the reflected glow of the red Cousin Town sign as they tracked down his smooth cheeks. The girl in the information booth flagged down the cop and said something to him. She was pretty. She was dark-haired, about 25. He was sandy blonde with a mustache. As the cop leaned in on his elbow, smiling at her, Sheridan thought they looked like the cigarette ads you saw on the backs of magazines. Salem, Spirit, Light My Lucky. He was dying out here, and they were in there making chit-chat. What you doing after work? You want to go and get a drink at that new place? And blah, blah, blah. Now she was also batting her eyes at him. How cute. Sheridan abruptly decided to take the chance. The kid's chest was hitching, and as soon as he started to bawl out loud, someone would notice him. Sheridan didn't like moving in with a cop less than 60 feet away, but if he didn't cover his markers at Mr. Reggie's within the next 24 hours, he thought a couple of very large men would pay him a visit and perform impromptu surgery on his arms, adding several elbow bends to each. He walked up to the kid, a big man dressed in an ordinary Van Heusen shirt and khaki pants, a man with a broad, ordinary face that looked kind at first glance. He bent over the little boy, hands on his legs just above the knees, and the boy turned his pale, scared face up to Sheridan's. His eyes were as green as emerald, their color accentuated by the light reflecting tears that washed them. "You get separated from your dad, son?" Sheridan asked. "My popsy," the kid said, wiping his eyes. I can't find my popsy." Now the kid did begin to sob, and a woman headed in glanced around with some vague concern. "It's all right," Sheridan said to her. She went on. Sheridan put a comforting arm around the boy's shoulders and drew him a little to the right in the direction of the van. Then he looked back inside. The rent-a-cop had his face right down next to the information girl's now. Looked like maybe more than that little girl's lucky was going to get lit tonight. Sheridan relaxed. At this point, there could be a stick-up going on at the bank just up the concourse, and the cop wouldn't notice a thing. This was starting to look like a cinch. "I want my popsy," the boy wept. "Sure you do. Of course you do," Sheridan said. "And we're going to find him. Don't you worry." He drew him a little more to the right. The boy looked up at him, suddenly hopeful. "Can you? Can you, mister?" "Sure," Sheridan said, and he grinned heartily. "Finding lost popsies, well, you might say it's kind of a specialty of mine." "It is?" The kid actually smiled a little, although his eyes were still leaking. It sure is, Sheridan said, glancing inside again to make sure the cop, whom he could now barely see, and who would barely be able to see Sheridan and the boy should he happen to look up, was still enthralled. He was. What was your popsy wearing, son? He was wearing a suit, the boy said. He almost always wears his suit. I only saw him once in jeans. He spoke as if Sheridan should know all of these things about his popsy. I bet it was a black suit, Sheridan said. The boys lit up. You saw him? Where? He started eagerly back toward the doors, tears forgotten, and Sheridan had to restrain himself from grabbing the pale-faced little brat right then and there. That type of thing was no good. Couldn't cause a scene, couldn't do anything people would remember later. Had to get him in the van. The van had sun-filtered glass everywhere, except in the windshield. It was almost impossible to see inside unless you had your face smashed right up against it. Had to get him in the van first. He touched the boy on the arm. I didn't see him inside, son. I saw him right over there. He pointed across the huge parking lot with its endless platoons of cars. There was an access road at the far end of it, and beyond that there were the double yellow arches of McDonald's. Well, why would Popsy go over there? The boy asked, as if either Sheridan or Popsy, or maybe both of them, had gone utterly mad. I don't know, Sheridan said. His mind was working fast, clicking along like an express train, as it always did when it got right down to the point, where you had to stop shitting and either do it upright or f*** it up righteously. Popsy, not Dad or Daddy, but Popsy. The kid had corrected him on it. Maybe Popsy meant Granddad, Sheridan decided. But I'm pretty sure that was him. Older guy in a black suit, white hair, green tie. Popsy had his blue tie on, the boy said. He knows I like it best. Yeah, it could have been blue, Sheridan said. You know, under these lights, who can tell? Come on, hop in the van. I'll run you over there to him. Are you sure it was Popsy? Because I don't know why he'd go to a place where they... Sheridan shrugged. Look, kid, if you're sure that wasn't him, maybe you better look for him on your own. You might even find him. And he started brusquely away, heading back toward the van. Kid wasn't biting. He thought about going back, trying again, but it had already gone on too long. You either kept observable contact to a minimum, or you were asking for 20 years in Hamilton Bay. He'd better go on to another mall. Scoterville, maybe, or... Wait, mister. It was the kid with panic in his voice. There was the thud of running sneakers. Wait up. I told him I was thirsty. He must have thought he had to go way over there to get me a drink. Wait. Sheridan turned around, smiling. I wasn't really going to leave you anyway, son. He led the boy to the van, which was 4 years old and painted a nondescript blue. He opened the door, smiled at the kid, who looked up at him doubtfully, his green eyes swimming in that pallid little face as huge as the eyes of a waif in a velvet painting, you know, the kind advertised in the cheap weekly tabloids like the National Enquirer and Inside View. Step into my parlor, little buddy, Sheridan said, and produced a grin which looked almost entirely natural. It was really sort of creepy how good he'd gotten at this. The kid did, and although he didn't know it, his ass belonged to Briggs Sheridan the minute the passenger door swung shut. There was only one problem in his life. It wasn't broads, although he liked to hear the swish of a skirt or feel the smooth smoke of a silken hose as well as any man. And it wasn't booze, although he had been known to take a drink or three of an evening. Sheridan's problem, his fatal flaw, you might even say, was cards. Any kind of cards, as long as it was the kind of game where wagers were allowed. He had lost jobs, credit cards, the home his mother had left him. He had never, at least so far, been in jail, but the first time he got in trouble with Mr. Reggie, he thought jail would be a rest cure by comparison. He had gone a little crazy that night. It was better he had found when you lost right away. When you lost right away, you got discouraged. You went home, you watched Letterman on the tube, and then went to sleep. When you won a little bit at first, you chased. Sheridan had chased that night and had ended up owing $17,000. He could hardly believe it. He went home dazed, almost elated by the enormity of it. He kept telling himself in the car on the way home that he owed Mr. Reggie not 700, not 7,000, but 17,000 iron men. Every time he tried to think about it, he giggled, turned up the volume on the radio. But he wasn't giggling the next night when the two gorillas, the ones who would make sure his arms bent in all sorts of new and interesting ways if he didn't pay up, brought him into Mr. Reggie's office. I'll pay, Sheridan began blabbing at once. I'll pay. Listen, it's no problem. Couple of days, a week at the most, 2 weeks at the outside. You bore me, Sheridan, Mr. Reggie said. Shut up. If I give you a week, don't you think I'll know what you'll do? You'll tap a friend for a couple of hundred, if you got a friend left to tap. If you can't find a friend, you'll hit a liquor store. If you've got the guts, I doubt you do. But anything is possible. Mr. Reggie leaned forward, propped his chin on his hands, and smiled. He smelled of Ted Lapidus cologne. And if you do come up with $200, what will you do with it? Give it to you, Sheridan had babbled. By then he was very close to tears. I'll give it to you right away. No, you won't, Mr. Reggie said. You'll take it to the track. You'll try to make it grow. What you'll give me is a bunch of shiny excuses. You're in over your head this time, my friend. Way over your head. Sheridan could hold back the tears no longer. He began to blubber. These guys could put you in the hospital for a long time, Mr. Reggie said reflectively. You'd have a tube in each arm and one coming out of your nose. Sheridan began to blubber even louder. I'll give you this much, Mr. Reggie said. He pushed a folded sheet of paper across his desk to Sheridan. You might get along with this guy. He calls himself Mr. Wizard, but he's a shitbag just like you. Now get out of here. I'm going to have you back here in a week, though, and I'll have your markers on this desk. You either buy them back, or I'm going to have my friends tool up on you. And like Booker T says, once they start, they do it till they're satisfied. The Turk's real name was written on the folded sheet of paper. Sheridan went to see him and heard about the kids and the boat rides. Mr. Wizard also named a figure which was a fairish bit larger than the markers Mr. Reggie was holding. That was when Sheridan started cruising the malls. He pulled out of Cousin Town's mall's main parking lot, looked for traffic, then drove across the access road and into the McDonald's in lane. The kid was sitting all the way forward on the passenger seat, hands on the knees of his toughskins, eyes agonizingly alert. Sheridan drove toward the building, swung wide to avoid the drive-through lane, and kept on going. Why are you going around the back? The kid asked. You have to go around to the other door, Sheridan said. Keep your shirt on, kid. I think I saw him in there. You did? You really did? I'm pretty sure, yeah. Sublime relief washed over the kid's face, and for a moment Sheridan felt sorry for him. Hell, he wasn't a monster or a maniac, for Christ's sake, but his markers had gotten a little deeper each time, and that bastard Mr. Reggie had no compunctions at all about letting him hang himself. It wasn't 17,000 this time, or 20,000, or even 25,000. This time it was 35 grand. A whole damn marching battalion of Iron Men, if he didn't want a few new sets of elbows by next Saturday. He stopped in the back by the trash compactor. Nobody was parked back there. Good. There was an elasticized pouch on the side of the door for maps and things. Sheridan reached into it with his left hand, brought out a pair of blue steel Krieg handcuffs. The loop jaws were open. Why are we stopping here, mister? The kid asked. The fear was back in his voice. But the quality of it had changed. He had suddenly realized that maybe getting separated from good old Popsy in the busy mall wasn't the worst thing that could happen to him after all. We're not, Ridley. We're not, Sheridan said easily. He had learned the second time he'd done this that you didn't want to underestimate even a six-year-old once he had his wind up. The second kid had kicked him in his balls and had damn near gotten away. I just remembered I forgot to put my glasses on when I started driving. I could lose my license. They're in that glasses case on the floor there. They slid over to your side. Could you hand them to me, would you? The kid bent over to get the glasses case, which was empty. Sheridan leaned over and snapped one of the cuffs on the kid's reaching hand as neat as you please, and then the trouble started. Hadn't he just been thinking it was a bad mistake to underestimate even a six-year-old? The brat fought like a timberwolf pup, twisting with a powerful muscularity Sheridan would not have credited had he not been experiencing it. He bucked and fought and lunged for the door, panting and uttering weird bird-like cries. He got the handle. The door swung open, but no dome light came on. Sheridan had broken it after that second outing. Sheridan got the kid by the round collar of his Penguins T-shirt and hauled him back in. He tried to clamp the other cuff on the special strut behind the passenger seat and missed. The kid bit his hand twice, bringing blood. God, his teeth were like razors. The pain went deep and sent a steely ache all the way up his arm. He punched the kid in the mouth. The kid fell back into the seat, dazed. Sheridan's blood on his lips and chin and dripping onto the ribbed neck of the T-shirt. Sheridan locked the other cuff onto the strut and then fell back into his own seat, sucking the back of his right hand. Pain was really bad. He pulled his hand away from his mouth and looked at it in the weak glow of the dash lights. Two shallow, ragged tears, each maybe 2 inches long, ran up toward his wrist from just above the knuckles. Blood pulsed in weak little rills. Still, he felt no urge to pop the kid again, and that had nothing to do with damaging the Turk's merchandise, in spite of the almost fussy way the Turk had warned him against that. "Damage the goods, and you damage the value," the Turk had said in his greasy accent. No, he didn't blame the kid for fighting. He would have done the same. He would have to disinfect the wound as soon as he could, though. Might even have to have a shot. He had read somewhere that human bites were the worst kind. Still, he couldn't help but admire the kid's guts. He dropped the transmission into drive. He pulled around the hamburger stand, past the drive-thru window, and back onto the access road. He turned left. The Turk had a big ranch-style house in Toluda Heights on the edge of the city. Sheridan would go there by secondary roads just to be safe. 30 miles, maybe 45 minutes, maybe an hour. He passed a sign which read, "Thank you for shopping the beautiful Cousin Town Mall." He turned left and let the van creep up to a perfectly legal 40 miles an hour. He fished a handkerchief out of his back pocket, folded it over the back of his right hand, and concentrated on following his headlights to the 40 grand the Turk had promised for a boy child. "You'll be sorry," the kid said. Sheridan looked impatiently around at him, pulled from a dream in which he had just won 20 straight hands and had Mr. Reggie groveling at his feet for a change, sweating bullets, begging him to stop. What did he want to do, break him? The kid was crying again. His tears still had that odd pinkish cast, even though they were now well away from the bright lights of the mall. Sheridan wondered for the first time if the kid might have some sort of communicable disease. He supposed it was a little late to start worrying about such things, so he put it out of his mind. "When my popsy finds you, you'll be sorry," the kid elaborated. "Yeah," Sheridan said, lit a cigarette. He turned off State Road 28 and onto an unmarked stretch of two-lane blacktop. There was a long, marshy area on the left, unbroken woods on the right. The kid pulled at the handcuffs and made a sobbing noise. "Quit it. It won't do you any good." Nevertheless, the kid pulled again. And this time there was a groaning, protesting sound Sheridan didn't like at all. He looked around and was amazed to see that the metal strut on the side of the seat, a strut he had welded in place himself, was twisted out of shape. "Shit," he thought. "He's got teeth like razors, and now I find he's also strong as a fucking ox. If this is what he's like when he's sick, God forbid I should have grabbed him on a day when he was feeling well." He pulled over onto the soft shoulder and said, "Stop it! I won't!" The kid yanked at the handcuff again. Sheridan saw the metal strut bend a little more. Christ, how could any kid do that? "It's panic," he answered himself. "That's how he can do it." But none of the others had been able to do it, and many of them had been a lot more terrified than this kid by this stage of the game. He opened the glove compartment in the center of the dash. He brought out a hypodermic needle. The Turk had given it to him and cautioned him not to use it unless he absolutely had to. "Drugs," the Turk said, pronouncing it drugs, "could damage the merchandise." "See this?" The kid gave the hypo a glimmering sideways glance and nodded. "You want me to use it?" The kid shook his head at once. Strong or not, he had any kid's instant terror of the needle, Sheridan was happy to see. "That's very smart. We'll put out your lights." He paused. He didn't want to say it. Hell, he was a nice guy, really, when he didn't have his ass in a sling, but he had to. "Might even kill you." Kid stared at him, lips trembling, cheeks papery with fear. "You stop yanking the cuff, I put away the needle. Deal?" "Deal," the kid whispered. "You promise?" "Yes." The kid lifted his lip, showing white teeth. One of them was spotted with Sheridan's blood. "You promise on your mother's name?" "I never had a mother." "Shit," Sheridan said, disgusted. Got the van rolling again. He moved a little faster now, and not only because he was finally off the main road. The kid was a spook. Sheridan wanted to turn him over to the Turk, get his money, and split. "My popsy's really strong, mister." "Yeah?" Sheridan asked and thought. "I bet he is, kid. Only guy in the old folks' home who could bench press his own truss, right? He'll find me." "Uh-huh. He can smell me." Sheridan believed it. He could smell the kid. That fear had an odor It was something he had learned on his previous expeditions, but this was unreal. The kid smelled like a mixture of sweat, mud, and slowly cooking battery acid. Sheridan was becoming more and more sure that something was seriously wrong with this kid. But soon that would be Mr. Wizard's problem, not his. And caveat emptor, as those old fellows in the togas used to say. Caveat f***ing emptor. Sheridan cracked his window. On the left, the marsh went on, broken slivers of moonlight glimmered in the stagnant water. Popsy can fly. Yeah, Sheridan said. After a couple of bottles of nitrine, I bet he flies like a son of a bitch, an eagle. Popsy, enough of the Popsy sh**, okay, kid? Kid, shut up. 4 miles farther on, the marsh on the left broadened into a wide, empty pond. Sheridan made a turn onto a stretch of hard-pan dirt that skirted the pond's north side. 5 miles west of here, he would turn right onto Highway 41, and from there it would be a straight shot into Toluda Heights. He glanced towards the pond, flat, silver sheet in the moonlight, and then the moonlight was gone, blotted out. Overhead, there was a flapping sound, like big sheets on a clothesline. Popsy, the kid cried. Shut up, it was only a bird. But suddenly he was spooked, very spooked. He looked at the kid again. The kid's lip was drawn back from his teeth again. His teeth were very white, very big. No, not big. Big wasn't the right word. Long was the right word. Especially the two at the top, at each side, the, what did you call them? The canines. His mind started to fly again, clicking along as if he was on speed. I told him I was thirsty. Why would Popsy go to a place where they eat? Was he going to say eat? He'll find me. He could smell me. Popsy can fly. Something landed on the roof of the van with a heavy, clumsy thump. Popsy! The kid screamed again, almost delirious with delight, and suddenly Sheridan could not see the road anymore. A huge, membranous wing, pulsing with veins, covered the windshield from side to side. Popsy can fly. Sheridan screamed. He jumped on the brake, hoping to tumble the thing on the roof off the front. There was that groaning, protesting sound of metal under stress from his right again, this time followed by a short, bitter snap. A moment later, the kid's fingers were clawing into his face, pulling open his cheek. He stole me, Popsy! The kid was screeching at the roof of the van in that bird-like voice. He stole me! He stole me! The bad man stole me! You don't understand, kid, Sheridan thought. He groped for the hypo and found it. I'm not a bad guy. I just got in a jam. Then a hand, more like a talon than a real hand, smashed through the side window and ripped the hypo from Sheridan's grasp, along with two of his fingers. A moment later, Popsy peeled the entire driver's side door out of its frame. The hinges now bright twists of meaningless metal. Sheridan saw a billowing cape, black on the outside, lined with red silk on the inside, and the creature's tie, and although it was actually a cravat, it was blue, all right, just as the boy had said. Popsy yanked Sheridan out of the car, talons sinking through his jacket and shirt and deep into the meat of his shoulders. Popsy's green eyes suddenly turned as red as blood roses. We came to the mall because my grandson wanted some Ninja Turtle figures, Popsy whispered. And his breath was like fly-blown meat. The ones they show on TV. All the children want them. You should have left him alone. You should have left us alone. Sheridan was shaken like a rag doll. He shrieked, was shaken again. He heard Popsy ask if the kid was still thirsty. Heard the kid saying, yes, very. The bad man had scared him and his throat was so dry. He saw Popsy's thumbnail for just a second before it disappeared under the shelf of his chin, the nail ragged and thick. His throat was cut with that nail before he realized what was happening. And the last things he saw before his sight dimmed to black were the kid cupping his hands to catch the flow the way Sheridan himself had cupped his hands under the backyard faucet for a drink on a hot summer day when he was a kid. And Popsy stroking the boy's hair gently with grandfatherly love. Thank you.
That was Stephen King's story, Popsy, read by Michael Imperioli. Here's my own contribution to the vampire genre, a letter I wrote to my colleague, the producer, Catherine Minton, while I was on the road with Selected Shorts in Los Angeles, wondering should we really be doing a vampire program the next Halloween. I was sort of making fun of the whole vampire genre. Here it is, and it's called Hotel Transylvania.
Seated by the roaring fire of my cavernous room in Castel Bel Air Lux, a vague feeling of apprehension crept over me, like the Southern California fog obscuring the crescent moon, which, with its two pointy ends, could not but fail to remind me of a set of two pointed, extended canine teeth. What it was, I knew not, but it was followed by a timid yet persistent knocking on my chamber 119 door. "What is it?" I shrieked through the barricaded and chained portal. A thin, eerie, Hispanic Transylvanian voice piped through the massive Gothic portal and replied,
"Beg pardon, sir. I just want to check the minibar."
"Oh, all right," I said, against my better judgment, and began the tortured process of opening the armaments that until then had guaranteed my safety. The creature, dressed like a chambermaid, backlit by the hallway corridor lighting, had long black hair flowing down to her belly button, or where I somewhat feverishly conjectured her belly button might be, beneath the ghastly white apron of her costume. Her skin was as pale as Häagen-Dazs ultra vanilla and dotted with the same small specks. Her eyes burned through me with an a priori knowledge that I had in fact already consumed one blood-red Diet Coke from the minibar's supply. But her teeth, good God, Colonel Basingstoke, can I ever forget those lunar daggers that protruded from her blood-red yet somehow simultaneously pale lips? She shimmied into the room, gently but firmly closing the door behind her with the stone metal clang of a mausoleum. Her smile, a testimonial to a kind of hellish orthodontics that I scarcely believed existed, caused me to shudder and retreat backward toward the baronial king-size bed that had just been turned down for the night. She'd followed me until the backs of my knees were forced against the mattress support. "What do you want?" I cried out in terror. "The minibar is that way. Don't you need to check the drinks I have consumed?" At the sound of these words, drink and consumed, a look of such venomous, death-loving thirst came over her face as she pushed me prostrate onto the bed, suddenly chilled like a good bottle of Chablis from Hungary. "The drink I crave does not sit in the minibar. It courses through your veins." I remember nothing more until I woke up this morning feeling pale, wan, and wasted, and with two little tooth marks on the left side of my neck. Tonight I shall walk the hills of Castle Getty, and when the dental moon reappears, I shall be thirsty for art-loving maidens. Thank you.
That was Hotel Transylvania, and yours truly, Isaiah Sheffer, author and reader. After a short break, we'll hear a touching father-daughter story set in the African outback. You're listening to Selected Shorts, recorded live in performance at Symphony Space in New York City, and at other venues nationwide. From PRI, Public Radio International. Welcome back to Selected Shorts. Our final creature of the night is not a vampire, but a bird, a red-crested heron that has become a rare species to sight in the African backcountry where the story is set. The author, Lisa Fugard, who is incidentally the daughter of the great South African dramatist Athol Fugard, grew up in South Africa and recreates the landscape of her childhood in this story. Listen carefully for the sound of the night creature in this father-daughter story. Lisa swears she remembers the sound and is reproducing it perfectly.
My father's hands were huge, slab-like. When he was idle, they seemed to hang off the ends of his arms like two chunks of meat. He sat on his hands during the months he courted my mother. When I was 13, I watched my thin hand disappear into his. It was at the train station at Modder River. I'd come home for the September holidays. It was hot, and the only other car at the small station pulled away. The siding at Modder River, 150 miles north of Johannesburg, was never busy. I remember it all clearly, standing in the dust, watching him get out of the car and walk towards me, noticing that there was no smile on his face, but still feeling my body reach towards him, my arms opening for an embrace, something rising in my throat. My father stopped and held out his right hand. Once in the car, I was filled with anxiety as to how close to him I could sit. I settled in the middle of my half of the bench seat and watched his large brown hand move from the steering wheel to the gear shift and back. I breathed deeply. Suddenly, I was filled with the smell of him. Borkum Riff tobacco, sweat, the sweet odor of cheap Cape brandy. Filled with his secrets, I felt like a thief and moved closer to the window. Then we were at the entrance to the Modder River Wildlife Sanctuary, and I jumped out of the car to open the gate. It swung easily once I unlatched it and banged against the wooden fence post, startling several guinea fowl that scampered into the veld. They slowed down. I mimicked their rattling call again. And they stopped. Again, and a few of them stepped hesitantly towards me. Laughing, I turned to find my father's smile, but his face was gone, blotted out by the expanse of blue sky reflected in the windshield. I have a gift for mimicking bird and animal calls. During my third year at boarding school, I'd finally made myself popular and gained the respect of Wendy Fenter, the bully of our dorm, by doing several calls late one night. It became a ritual, and every couple of weeks around midnight, I'd hear rustling and whispering from the 11 other girls in the dormitory. Then a balled-up sock would land on my bed, usually right next to my head, and Wendy would call my name in a sly whisper, "Marlene." The dorm would fall silent. Lying back in the darkness, I'd start with the deep moan of the spotted eagle owl. Hoo, 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 hoo. Then the high-pitched yips of the black-backed jackal. The low snuffle and violent laugh of the hyena. And then a deadly combination. The rasping, half-swallowed growl of the leopard, followed by the wild scream of the chukma baboon. Inevitably, one of the younger girls would begin to cry, and I'd hear Wendy snickering in the darkness. I told my father about this during my next trip home, about how much the other girls had enjoyed it, and I offered to do it for him one evening. Offered to steal into his room at midnight, crouch at the foot of his bed, and make the calls for him. He'd shaken his head ever so slightly. "I've got the real thing right outside my window," he said. As we drove up to our house now, I noticed the shabby state of the compound. The road was rutted and washed out in many places by the spring rains. The visitor's kiosk was boarded up, and the map of the sanctuary had been knocked off its post and lay on the ground. Even the pond had been neglected. When my parents first came to Modder River, 5 years before I was born, my father had had the pond dug out for my mother. An avid botanist, she'd planted it with indigenous water lilies that she collected, along with bulrushes, 7 weeks ferns, and floating hearts. During the 2 years that the Modder River was reduced to a trickle by the drought, the local farmers were astonished to hear that my father was actually pumping precious water from our borehole into the pond to prevent it from drying up. An opulent jewel in the dusty, cracked landscape, it became a haven for birds, being visited by pied kingfishers, mountain chats, spoonbills, bokmakiris, a pair of black-shouldered kites. All total, my mother counted 107 different species. Now, a thick layer of brown scum covered the shallow, stagnant water. I remembered a letter that I'd received from my father several months before. The scrawling handwriting hadn't even looked like his. I'd read it once and then hidden it away, scared by the extreme loneliness that he'd hinted at. None of this seemed to matter, however, when I stood amongst our dogs, being pelted with paws and tails and long pink tongues. King, with his tail plumed like an ostrich feather, and Blitz, a lean black shadow. They clattered behind me as I went into my bedroom. The room was still and dark and smelled musty. Quickly, I opened the wooden shutters. I moved to the chest of drawers and found the large framed photograph of my mother, frozen at age 32. She was laughing, and her head was turned slightly as a lock of hair blew across her face. I traced her jawline with my finger and moved to the mirror with the photograph, but the dogs were demanding, barking and pawing at my legs. I ran outside with them and chased them up and down the cool stone lengths of the veranda, flying past the living room and the dining room, screeching past my father's study, and back again with the dogs racing behind me. Back and forth I went until the force of motion made me round the corner past my parents' old bedroom. I stopped, panting, trying to catch my breath. I stared at the large fenced-in area under the blue gum tree. It was where my father kept the red-crested night heron, the last of its kind. The year that the park officials brought the bird to Modder River had been a difficult one. My mother was killed in a car accident just before my 8th birthday. Numbly, I watched my father make funeral arrangements with the help of his sister Annette, who drove up from Johannesburg. She was adamant. There was no way I could stay at Modder River. It was too remote, and there was my schooling to consider. My mother had been my tutor. As for my father, it made no sense for him to remain grieving in a place so closely associated with his wife. My father was on the point of resigning as warden of the small sanctuary when park officials telephoned about the bird. The red-crested night heron had been captured at the flay on Nita Fair, the farm abutting the sanctuary's eastern border, and the National Parks Board wanted the heron kept at Modder River in the slim chance that they might find a mate for it. A Mr. van Jaarsveld arrived with the bird. "We had to tie the bugger's beak up, otherwise he'd have cut us to ribbons," he said, as he placed a large burlap bag in the pen my father had hastily constructed. He opened the bag and then quickly stepped out and shut the gate. A few moments of silence, then a wild flurry of wings, the sound of the air being thumped, and the heron hit the wire at the top of the pen and came crashing down. Again and again, till the bird lay in the dust exhausted, its wings useless. Quietly, my father opened the gate and stepped inside the pen. For several minutes, he squatted on his haunches in the corner, and then slowly he inched his way towards the bird. Kneeling alongside it, he checked the feathers for damage, spreading the wings on the ground in front of him like a fan. Then, making soft noises in the back of his throat, he untied the strip of burlap around the heron's beak. My father stayed on at Modder River, and arrangements were made for me to go to boarding school. During school holidays, I came home, and my father would share the latest developments with me. He showed me articles from the local papers lauding the conservation efforts surrounding the heron, as well as articles from foreign countries in languages we couldn't understand. He showed me the stamp that the South African government issued, a 37-cent stamp with the heron's lean profile and brilliant crest. And once, he gave me a feather, a long steel-gray feather from the tip of the heron's wing, a flight feather, and it was smooth as I stroked it against my cheek during the overnight train ride back to boarding school. But after 2 or 3 years, interest in the heron faded, the articles died down, and in private, the National Parks Boards expressed their doubts to my father that they would ever find a mate for the bird. The sanctuary was small, and apart from a secretive leopard, we didn't have any of the big five, animals like elephant and lion that attracted tourists. Modder River returned to the way it used to be, a trickle of visitors on the occasional weekend. I stared at the pen for a long time now. I knew what was in there. A large gray bird with ugly hooked feet, a long slithery neck that gave me nightmares, and a red crest that was raised during the courtship ritual. I had never seen the crest, but once I'd caught a glimpse of a small red feather that had escaped from the heron's crown. There was no need to walk through the dust to look at the bird under the swaying blue gum tree branches. I went anyway. Effortlessly, I climbed the blue gum tree, but now it was difficult for me to squeeze into the small fork halfway up. The heron pecked listlessly at a dried-out fish, and I noticed that the pen hadn't been cleaned in quite a while. I'd spent many school holidays in the tree, watching my father as he fed the bird, collected the feathers during the molt, and proudly chatted to visitors. Maybe he'd known that I was up there all the time. I shivered. The sun had set, taking all the warmth with it, and a thin veil of light pressed against our house and the Modder River as it crawled like a fat brown snake out of the mountains. Walking back down the length of the veranda, I peered through the windows of the rooms we'd stopped using. The dining room, with its yellow wood table. The living room, where my mother's desk was still piled high with the field guides and books she'd used to identify unknown plants she'd come across. The outside lights flickered on, and I found my father in the kitchen, heating up a tin of curry. We ate our dinner in silence, and then he read a book, and I listened to the radio. I felt uncomfortable in the house and longed for the morning when I could go racing through the veld with the dogs, go out looking for tracks, and walk far into the sanctuary. At 10 p.m., as was custom, my father switched off the electricity generator and went to his study where he slept. The low hum now gone, I lay in bed and let the night overtake me, hungrily following the calls in the darkness. A jackal marking his territory, the rhythmic eruptions of spring bullfrogs, the steady breath of King at the foot of my bed. And then I heard another familiar sound, the creaking of the gate on the heron's pen. Gently, I felt my way down the hall and into my parents' old bedroom. I hid behind the soft lace curtains, and as my eyes grew accustomed to the night, I saw my father move slowly across the compound, carrying the heron gently under his arm, its long legs dangling at his side. The heron's neck was liquid in the moonlight, curving and swaying, at times seeming to entwine my father. Its beak glinted like a dagger. One of my father's hands followed the bird's neck, lightly touching it at times, while the other was sunk deep into the heron's soft breast, pale gray feathers around his wrist. My father slipped by with the bird, and I went back to bed and stared into the darkness. Later on, I heard a tremulous wail repeated several times. It came from the river. I knew it was the red-crested night heron, even though I'd never heard its call before. And I thought about my father, in the darkness, on the banks of the Modder River with the bird. At breakfast the next morning, my father told me that a hyena had gotten the best of us, had finally broken into the heron's pen because the bird had disappeared. Under the blue gum tree, we examined a huge hole in the fence. "Yes, I think so, Dad," I said, and nodded in agreement as we watched King and Blitz sniff inside the pen. He seemed lighter and chattered to me about school as I helped him dismantle the fence. "Hyena," he had said, with such authority. He told me that now he might even be able to come to the end-of-the-year recital at my school. That night, I made fried bananas and ice cream for dessert, and we listened to a radio play together. At 10, just before he switched off the generator, I looked in the mirror and thought, I have his eyes. In bed, in the blackness, I listened to the night again. The jackal that had been barking the previous night had moved on, and it seemed quiet out there. It wasn't long before I heard the heron calling. I knew my father heard it as well, and I tried to picture him in his bed. I wondered if his heart beat like mine, an urgent knocking in my chest. I rolled over and thought of the red-crested night heron, alone by the river, the last of its kind. And I imagined that its crest was raised and that it picked its way delicately through the muddy water, lifting its feet up like wet handkerchiefs. The following night, I heard the heron's call again, and I also heard footsteps leaving our house. I knew it was my father going down to the river. For 10 nights, the heron called, and my father followed. During the days, we worked on repairing things around the compound. We cleaned up the pond and made a day trip to the western corner of the sanctuary, where the Modder River dropped abruptly into a densely forested ravine. Gnarled trees hung with a thick gray moss that I called Old Man's Beard. We collected water lilies from the dappled pools, wrapping their roots in damp newspaper and placing them in our packs. Baboons barked from the rocky ledges. We saw the spoor of the leopard, two pug marks in the rich black mud. For the drive home, I sat in the back of the truck. As my father shifted to low gear and negotiated the sandy part of the road that ran alongside the river, I scanned the banks, hoping to catch a glimpse of the heron roosting, waiting for nightfall. I spent a day repairing the signs along the succulent trail, a one-mile loop that wound through an area that my father had filled with rare plants, Aloe albida, Aloe monotropa, a Leidenberg cycad. We put the mat back on its post and touched it up with small pots of paint, the Modder River a blue vein in the brown landscape. Then, one long night, I didn't hear the heron's call. The bird had disappeared. And when I got out of bed the next morning, I saw that my father's eyes had gone dull, like a dead animal's. I knew why, but couldn't say anything. Then he started walking all the time, often coming home only for an hour or two in the early dawn. I'd hear the creak of the floorboards near the kitchen and the thud of Blitz's tail on the floor. I'd hear my father pacing, then eventually, stillness. He's lying on the sofa in his study. He's asleep now, I'd say to myself. Then the pacing again, and the soft slam of the screen door. From the blue gum tree, I'd see him crisscrossing the felt like a rabid dog, always coming back to touch the river. Straining my eyes, I'd watch him walk farther and farther away until the moment when he vanished into the landscape. Accidentally, I found the heron's remains. I was out late one afternoon, looking for a snakeskin for my next school biology project. I had chosen a rocky area where I'd seen cobras and puff adders sunning themselves. And as I moved slowly through it, poking into crevices with a stick, I came across a broken fan of bloodied feathers. The steel-gray patina was unmistakable, and I knew it was part of the heron's wing. I scratched out a hole with my stick and buried the feathers, pushing a large rock over the small grave. I made sandwiches for supper that night. I made extra ones for my father, but he didn't come home. I sat on the veranda with King and Blitz until 10 o'clock when I switched off the generator. Swiftly, silently, I followed the footpath down to the far bank of the river, pushing my way through the warm water that came up to my waist. I hid in the reeds and waited. An hour later, I saw my father on the opposite bank, looking, listening. He sat down on the dark sand and rolled a pebble in his large palms. I crouched even lower. Slowly, I tilted my head back until my throat was wide open and a tremulous wail slid out. My father stood up and looked across the water to where I was crouched. Again I made the sound. Again and again. He took three more small steps towards my side of the river, and his hands fluttered like giant tawny moths in the moonlight.
Lisa Fugard reading her own story, Night Calls. You can find this story and other fine readings on the Selected Shorts CD, Getting There From Here. For more information, go to selectedshorts.org. Selected Shorts is produced by Catherine Minton and directed by Isaiah Sheffer. The executive director of Symphony Space is Cynthia Elliott. Our radio producer is Sarah Montague, and our production assistant is Miranda Schaefer. The readings are recorded by Miles B. Smith, and our mix engineer is Stu Kennedy. Our programs presented at the Getty Center in Los Angeles are recorded by Phil Richards. Our theme music is Roger Kellaway's Come to the Meadow. Major support for Selected Shorts is provided by Houghton Mifflin, publishers of the Best American Short Stories, edited in 2009 by Alice Siebold. Additional support is provided by the Dungannon Foundation, sponsor of the Ray Award for the Short Story, the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art, New York State Council on the Arts, a state agency, the Henry Nias Foundation, Lila Acheson Wallace Theater Fund of the New York Community Trust, and Warren and Jane Weiss and the Applebaum Foundation. Selected Shorts is a co-production of Symphony Space and WNYC Radio in New York and is distributed nationwide by PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Hi, I'm Isaiah Sheffer. Greetings to our Selected Shorts podcast audience. If you've always wanted to be a selector of shorts yourself, here's your chance. On June 9th, 2010, Selected Shorts at Symphony Space in New York will feature published stories selected by you, our audience, nationwide. Go to selectedshorts.org/favorite to submit your story suggestions. Then, in the spring, you'll vote for your favorite of the final contenders.